So this week we have the final parsha of Chumash Bereishis, and as we will see, there's a great deal of parshanut to be consulted, both of a general nature and of a specific nature as well. And the opening section of the parsha, of course, is Yaakov's request from Yosef. That's in Perek Mem Zayin. He calls Yosef, and towards the end of the pasuk, Kaftes, V'asiso imadi chesed ve'emes, do with me true kindness, al na tikbareini b'mitzrayim. Don't bury me in Mitzrayim. And as we know, Rashi has quite a bit to say. Rashi supplies us from Chazal with no less than three reasons why Yaakov did not wish to be buried in Mitzrayim. And these are, it's a well-known Rashi. Firstly, says Rashi, Sofa liyos afara kinim. In the fullness of time, a certain stage, the dust of Mitzrayim will become kinim. That's a reference to Makas kinim, the plague of lice. Umarachashin tachas gufi. They'll be rummaging around there under my body. Yaakov is not prepared for that to happen. That's reason number one. Number two, says Rashi, V'she'ein meisei chutzal la'aretz chayim ele betzar gilgul mechilos. The deceased of chutz la'aretz, they will only come back to life in the time of Tchias HaMesim through the difficult travels in those tunnels, subterranean. It will be an unpleasant experience. Someone who's buried in Eretz Yisrael doesn't have to undergo that discomfort. Finally, V'shelo ya'asuni Mitzrayim avodos kochavim, that the Egyptians shouldn't turn me into avodah zarah. After all, Yaakov was something that they'd never seen before in Mitzrayim. He had only to turn up in the country and the famine stopped. I mean, that made him a national treasure. And the nature of these things, Yaakov is worried that they turn him into avodah zarah. So he wants to exit as quickly as possible. It's a very interesting combination, shall we say, of reasons, from the discomfort of lice to the discomfort of tunnel travel to the prospect of being avodah zarah. One would say that Rashi say best for us. What is a bit of discomfort compared to being an object of idolatry? And in a sense, the question, the Rashi question, I would say, that I would like to deal with here, which is discussed by Mefarshi Rashi, is this. Rashi has given us three reasons why Yaakov does not wish to be buried in Mitzrayim. The question is, why did Rashi give us three reasons? Could it be, because Yaakov had three reasons, and Rashi's telling us what they were? It often happens that people have more than one reason for what it is that they do or what they want. And it happens to be that Yaakov had three things on his mind. So it's very clearly a matter of letting us know, through the Masorah, why Yaakov made this request. Or could it be that there's more to it than that? Rashi gives us these three reasons because if were it not for these three reasons, there's something about the pasuk that we may not completely understand. In other words, when we study Chumash, there are two questions. Number one, what happened and how much do we know about that? Number two, what does the pasuk describe and how much do we need to know to make sense of the pasuk, to have a straight reading of the psukim? And the first to discuss this question is the Mizrahi, of course, Rosh HaMedabrim of Mefarshi Rashi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi. And he says, well, let's consider. We should note, of course, that Yaakov has two requests, essentially. His one request is double-barreled. Number one, of course, not in Mitzrayim. That's, one could say, Sur Meirah. But he not only has a request where he doesn't wish to be buried, but where he does. Unasasani mimitzrayim, ukvartani bukvarasam. He wants to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. And the question, therefore, is how many of these reasons would we need in order to understand why he would request both of those things? Well, when we consider them one by one, the first two reasons are not reason enough to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. They're more reasons not to be buried in Mitzrayim. After all, the first reason, he doesn't want there to be the lice to be under his body. Well, that's only a problem if you're in Eretz Mitzrayim. But if you're in outside of Mitzrayim, or perhaps some suggested even in the land of Goshen, as far as we know, these plagues did not occur in Goshen. And many of the Jewish people yet lived, most if not, certainly most of the Jewish people lived in Goshen. Yaakov could be buried in Goshen, and that would be off location for Makas Kinim. Doesn't yet require being buried in Eretz Canaan. By the same token, the third problem, shall we say, of not being turned into an Avodah Zarah, that's only if Mitzrayim have access to him. That's only if he's once again buried on the premises, but if they take him somewhere else, one owns to be not in Mitzrayim in order to deal with those two problems. On the other hand, the only one of the three reasons that would actually require Yaakov to be taken into Mitzrayim, pardon me, into Eretz Canaan, is the one about the tunnels to Eretz Yisrael, because anywhere in Chutz La'aretz will have that problem. It's specifically in Eretz Yisrael. However, if that is the reason, and it's the only one that takes Yaakov all the way to Eretz Yisrael, there's another question. Tchias HaMesim, until further notice, is not happening anytime soon. This doesn't mean that Yaakov needs to be buried straight away in Eretz Canaan. He could conceivably make the request, much like Yosef did of his brothers, that when you leave, and you will leave, va'alisem esatz mosai mize etchem, that you'll take me with you. But Yaakov actually doesn't wish to wait. But why is he in such a hurry? And in fact, the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh HaSor derives this from the Pasuk, for Yaakov says, uses the word na quite a few times, and Pasuk Kaftes, three times, in fact, which could perhaps be an explanation of bakasha, please. But when he says al na tikbereini b'mitzrayim, the word na, we shouldn't forget, as much as we are used to the idea that it's an expression of bakasha, but first and foremost, the word na means now. Ana Hashem Hoshia na means now. And therefore, al na tikbereini b'mitzrayim means Yaakov doesn't wish to be buried even now and just moved later on, but rather straight away in Eretz Canaan. And therefore, none of the three explanations will fully give us an understanding as to why Yaakov wants to be buried in Eretz Canaan straight away. One would need more than one. However, as the Gemara itself often comments, perhaps one explanation won't do it alone, but maybe two of them will. It doesn't mean you'll need three. And when you consider, says the Mizrahi, that any one of the two reasons for not being buried in Mitzrayim, either the lice or the Avodah Zorah, coupled with the issue of the tunnels of Tchias HaMesim, the two of them would give us the composite result of being taken straight away to Eretz Yisrael. One wouldn't need all three. And therefore, says the Mizrahi, it seems that Rashi here is telling us the three reasons, not because with less than three wouldn't understand why Yaakov isn't making this request, but rather, very simply, because there were three reasons. And this is an approach which is echoed by a later Mefarish of Rashi, Rabbi Yaakov Selnik, in the Nachlas Yaakov. He's actually famous for causing trouble for the Mizrahi on more than one occasion, but in this instance he heartily agrees with him, and in fact he says more, that the truth of the matter is that even all three of the reasons put together will not fully explain to us where Yaakov wants to be buried, because The reasons tell us not in Mitzrayim, it's got to be in Eretz Canaan. But where in Eretz Canaan? Well, Yaakov has very specific instructions about that. It's about being in Ma'aretz HaMachpelah. But none of these reasons give you this result. The most you can get to is not here, but in Eretz Canaan, which means that in any event, Yaakov wants to be buried specifically in Ma'aretz HaMachpelah. And if that's the case, then perhaps even the one reason that he doesn't want to be buried straight away in Mitzrayim, coupled with the fact that he wants to be in Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, will give you the entire picture. And therefore, says the Nachlas Yaakov, I concur with the Mizrahi, that Rashi isn't telling us these three reasons to explain anything in the Pasuk, but rather that all three reasons were extant. I saw, actually, worthwhile mentioning parenthetically, in the commentary on the Chodesh Shel Pesach, Yad Mitzrayim, of Rabbi Isaac Chover, with regards to the Makkah of Kinim, which is interesting because it seems to be the, perhaps, most comfort-based of all of them. It's not a religious issue of Avodah Zorah or such like. But Yaakov wouldn't want to be there when the Kinim were there. So Rabbi Isaac Chover says that actually what that means is that if Yaakov were to be buried in Mitzrayim, there would be no Makas Kinim, because the sanctity of Yaakov himself would preclude such a Makkah that would affect him in that way. And therefore, in the interest of the Makkahs going Keseder, Yaakov says, take me away and let whatever needs to happen, happen. However, we should note that there is a different view, because if we take the approach of the Mizrahi and the Nachlas Yaakov, then Rashi seems to be departing from his norm. Rashi's job is never just, quote-unquote, to tell us things of interest or to tell us things that happen to be true. If that was Rashi's pool to draw from, Rashi's commentary would be 10 times larger than it is, because there's plenty of interesting things. You'll find them in the Medrash Rabbah and the Medrash Tanchuma, but Rashi's job is liyashiv pshuta shel mikra, in order to explain the psukim. And therefore the Maharal, in his comments, Yirios Shlomo, on Rashi, he insists that here Rashi is true to form. It's all about explaining the pasuk, except if we ask the question, well, you don't need three explanations, three reasons to explain his request, says Marshal, no. But if you look at the pasuk, you will see that Yaakov seems to be making the same request three times. Because in the end of pasuk kaftes, it says, Al natik bereini b'mitzrayim, which is request number one. Pasuk lamed v'shachavtiim avosai is actually a reference to him passing away, as Rashi says. But then, unesasani b'mitzrayim, remove me from Mitzrayim, ukvartani b'kvurasam, and bury me where they are. In a sense, you could say, Rashi, Yaakov could have just told us the last one, and then it presupposes all the earlier ones. But actually, we see that in two ways he's asking not to be buried in Mitzrayim. Al natik bereini b'mitzrayim, and take me away from Mitzrayim. And then the third request is ukvartani b'kvurasam, and therefore says the Marshal, Rashi looks at those words of Yaakov carefully and sees that he has two reasons not to be buried in Mitzrayim, lice and avodah zarah, and one reason, yes, to be buried in Eretz Canaan, generally, which is the issue of those tunnels in Trias HaMesim. And all of this is before Yaakov gets to specifically where Eretz Canaan he'd like to be buried, in Ma'aretz HaMachpelah. So that's a very interesting way of looking at the pasuk. Rashi is as always, his job is to explain the psukim to us. Okay, so that is how the parsha begins. Most of the parsha, and certainly most of Rashi on the parsha, is devoted to the brachos that Yaakov gives to his sons, and that's in Perek Memtes. And before we get to one of the brachos specifically, one of the sons, I'd like to just make a general comment with regards to these brachos. What is the goal of the brachos? Well, what is the content of the brachos? We see that it's not only, quote-unquote, that Yaakov wishes his sons well. I mean, he has very specific brachos for each of them. And what he's doing in each case is pointing out some special quality about each of the sons, whether it's Yehuda, will be the leadership, and where they will be and what they'll be doing. That's their bracha. For a person to know their strength and their uniqueness, that's their bracha. They know what to work with, what to work on. Except the timing of the brachas. After all, if we ask a Balabatisha a question, a lot of these brachas will not be relevant for many, many years to come, decades. In the sense that, well, one could argue that Yehuda is already kind of a leader, but the way that the Mefarshim talk about it, certainly the Malchus of Yehuda, I mean, that's centuries in coming. Zevulun l'chof yamim yishkon. Zevulun will be on the coast, and that's his area. He's not going to be on the coast anytime soon. And so it is with many of them. But Yaakov is already talking to them about this now. And sometimes the Balabatisha question deserves a Balabatisha answer. One could say, well, when else are you going to talk about them? Ein achshavei masai. I mean, these are his parting words to them. He's not going to be with them later on to point out each one's specialty. So it will be a long time in coming, but this is the last opportunity that Yaakov has to talk about it. However, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a wonderful insight into the timing of these brachos and the relevance of Yaakov disclosing to each of the sons what their forte is. Here we are, Jewish people are essentially descending into Golos. It's kind of been okay, as okay as Golos can be, when Yaakov is alive. As soon as Yaakov passes away, things get a little darker, and they will get darker still. And Golos is difficult for the Jewish people. And as a people, they've never experienced Golos before, even though there have been precursors, and Avram's in Mitzrayim, and Yaakov has been with Laban. There is a very real worry, because people can choose what they want to choose, that the Jewish people may choose to give up. They may not have the idea of redemption solidified for them as a reality. Very difficult to know how to protect against that. Conditions will become progressively more difficult for them. How can you help them? So Rabbi Yaakov says, the way that you help prevent a person from despairing or from giving up is to give them hope. But it's sometimes not enough to give someone hope in a general way. To say, it will be better, you'll be redeemed, yetov. That doesn't really help anyone. That's another way of saying you don't really have anything to say. However, if you can find some way to make it more specific, to make it more crystallized, then you can make it more real. If each tribe not only carries with it a general notion that redemption will come, but it carries with it its own unique role when the redemption does come. That's something which gives the Jewish people, each one with their specialty, much more stamina. Because now Yaakov is saying not only the redemption will come, but it will come, and you, Zevulun, will be by the coast. Zevulun now thinks of the coast of Eretz Yisrael, and Yehuda thinks of Malchus, and each one, he's already been told specifically what their contribution will be. That's a different order of magnitude in terms of the chizuk and the encouragement and the staying power that it will give them. That's the comment of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. If you want to help a person who's in a slump, you have to tell them something specific that makes it more real for them. And in fact, Rabbi Yaakov echoes this sentiment later on in his comments on the Torah, in the beginning of Parshas Truma. For there we are told, as the pasuk details all of the component parts of the Mishkan, and there was Zahav and Kesef and Achoshes, and one of the components was Atze Shittim, cedar trees. Rashi there tells us in the Medrash Tanchuma, cedar trees? Where did they get cedar trees from? Yaakov brought them to Mitzrayim, he planted them in Beersheba, and they brought them to Mitzrayim, and that's where they got cedar trees from. Now once again, I mean, here we ask a slightly different question. I think that if they didn't have cedar trees in Mitzrayim, but they needed them in the Midbar, Hashem would have provided them. Much as he provided pretty much everything else that they needed that they didn't bring with them from Mitzrayim. They had gold and silver, okay, so that they didn't need. They didn't have food, Hashem provided. Whatever else they might need, they needed the Tcheles. Where are you going to get Tcheles from? Hashem provided the Chilazon, whatever they need, that's what they'll get. Hashem is not going to ask of them that which is impossible. So it's very interesting that if it's from a purely practical point of view, Yaakov is saying, you know, there'll be a Mishkan. Where are we going to get cedar trees from? We'll have to bring our own. That seems to be lacking somewhat in reliance on Hashem to provide whatever it is that they'll need. Rather, says Rabbi Yaakov, what is happening here is something else. Once again, a slightly different angle. When Yaakov wishes to keep the idea of Geula alive for his children, if there's something concrete you can point to, it changes things. It makes it more of a reality for them. It's not just an abstract idea. Which means that all through, if one can now imagine, the difficult times, and the parents are telling their children, beginning with Yaakov telling them that there will be Geula, and will leave, and there'll be a Mishkan, with these trees. Zeh, ba'avur zeh, something you can point to, something you can see in front of you, then that again, like their brachas, is keeping this idea much more alive and stays with them until the time for Geula. Keeps them intact. So these are comments of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and subsequently I found that the idea precedes him somewhat, for it's to be found in the writings of the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Va'era. And not only does he, shall we say, pre-echo the sentiments of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, but he even says something even more far-reaching, as we will see. He begins, the Meshech Chochma begins, by referring us to a statement in the Medrash Bamidbar Rabbah. And there it says that the three tribes of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, all of those three, and these are the words of the Medrash Rabbah, Nohagu Sarara b'Mitzrayim. Nohagu Sarara b'Mitzrayim. They had some type of nobility in Mitzrayim. Now, of course, everything's relative, and the entire Jewish people were Avodah Mayinu, but nonetheless, and perhaps as we are more familiar with the idea that Shevet Levi, although they are one of the 12 tribes, nonetheless, they were not involved in the Shibud for reasons that are well known. They didn't get involved in the beginning, they weren't ensnared, and they kind of kept to themselves a little bit more. But the Medrash Rabbah is telling us that not only was this true of Shevet Levi, Velo Shevet Levi Bilvad, but also the other true olds, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, all of them had a relatively easier time in Mitzrayim than the others. Nahagu Srara, there were different tiers of slavery and oppression, apparently. And the question is, why? I mean, we may ask, they're all equally Jewish. Levi, we know, they were learning Torah and they didn't get involved. But Reuven and Shimon, how? What's behind this idea that they had a milder experience in Mitzrayim than the other tribes? And Meshech Chochma says, and here we will see the resonance of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's idea. Each of the tribes was only able to weather the harsh oppression of Mitzrayim thanks to the bracha that they got from Yaakov. That's the chizuk, and kept them going, just like Rabbi Yaakov said. And Yehuda will be this, and Asher will be this, and Naphtali will be this, Naphtali Svaratzor, or he knows it in Meshefer, Ayala Sholucha. Aha. So Meshech Chochma says, okay, if everyone gets their chizuk from their bracha, we'll take a look at the brachas for Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. And you will see that they are of the, we say, less encouraging side. Because there was a great deal of rebuke there. Reuven's, as you see from the Psukim, and Rashi comments, and so do all the Mefarshim, each one in their own way. Reuven was told what he had, and then what he lost. Reuven Bechori Ate, you should have been king, should have been the Kohen, but you lost it. I mean, There's only a certain amount of chizuk that a person can get from a message like that. Shimon the Levi, Achim, they got going with Shechem and possibly with Mechiras Yosef, and that's their message. Now, there is a message, of course, because underneath all of those episodes where things came out slightly wrong, there are tremendous strengths, and they need to be aware of this for the future and how to channel it, etc. But certainly, there doesn't seem to be an overt theme of encouragement. So much so, Rashi tells us, when the time for Yehuda came, he started hiding behind his brothers. I mean, he's next. And look what happened to Reuven. Shimon and Levi, each one had their episode. Yehuda had his own episodes. Yehuda with Tamar, and maybe with Bechiras Yosef also. Yaakov had to pull him out from the crowd. Yehuda, atah yoducha checha, you're okay. Because who knows what was next? And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, amazingly, the ability to withstand the difficulties of the Golas was a product of the encouragement they got from the brachas. And therefore, because the nature of the brachas of the first three tribes was less encouraging, they were less resilient, they would have been able to put up with less, and that's why they actually got less within their Golas experience. That's quite a chiddush from the Meshech Chochma. And so, having discussed, commented on the brachas generally, let us take a look, and quite a good look, Mir Tashem, at the brachas of Dan. Very difficult to get past the first few, but we have to forge ahead. And that's in Peret Memtes, Pasuk Tet Zayin to Yud Ches. Tet Zayin. Dan, if we read and translate the psukim, we'll already be preparing the ground for much of the comment. Dan Yadin Amo, Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael, simply translated, Dan will judge his people like one of the tribes of Israel. Yi Dan Nachash Alei Derech, he'll be a snake on the road. Shefifon Alei Orech, another type of snake on the path. Hanosheich Ikvesus, who bites the heel of the horse, by Yipol Rochvo Achor, so that the rider falls over backwards. And then, final pasuk, Lishuoscha Kivisi Hashem. I've waited for your salvation, Hashem. And as we can appreciate, there are a number of very basic questions to ask with regards to this bracha of Dan. Firstly, we ask, who exactly is this bracha about? The two possibilities are what perhaps one might think is the intuitive understanding, that it's about the tribe of Dan. I mean, it's said to Dan, Dan will become a tribe, and it's about the tribe of Dan. Alternatively, it could be about a specific individual, specific personality within the tribe of Dan. And we have to keep an eye on those two possibilities. Secondly, when the pasuk says in Tet Zayin, Dan Yadin Amo, what is the meaning of those words, Yadin Amo? When we see the word Yadin, we think of Din, which is judgment, which means that the pasuk seems to be saying that Dan will judge his people. Except if that is true, where did this happen? And if it isn't what the pasuk means, what else might it mean with these words, Dan Yadin Amo? Moreover, Dan Yadin Amo, he will judge, seemingly, his people. Who are his people? Again, the simple understanding is his people, the Jewish people. Could there be a reference to another people that are called the people of Dan? Dan Yadin Amo. Further, I mean, we're really looking very closely at this pasuk because it seems to be rather vague. Dan Yadin Amo, Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael. He will judge his people like one of the tribes of Israel. That's actually a rather difficult bracha, because one should hope he'll judge them like one of the tribes of Israel. He is one of the tribes of Israel. So it doesn't seem to be very geared towards Dan to say, this will be your quality like everyone else. Then he's like everyone else. So then what's so special about Dan? And finally, of course, that pasuk yud ches after the bracha lishivosra kivisi Hashem, I wait for your salvation, Hashem. What's that got to do with Dan? I mean, that's always true. That should be true for Reuven, or say it at the end. But it's said specifically here at this juncture. And as we will see, Mefarshim, having raised some of the basic questions with regards to this bracha, these psukim, Mefarshim, Rishonim, are divided into two schools here. And we will take a look at them one by one. Naneh, Rishon, Rishon. The first approach, which is taken by Rashi and Ramban and others, but Rashi and Ramban write at length, is that actually the reference in this bracha, which is given to Dan, is to a specific personality within Dan, and that, of course, is Shimshon, the most famous of those that come from Dan. And if we look at Rashi, on the words Dan Yadin Amo at the beginning of Pasuk Tet Zayin, Rashi explains, Yinkom Nikmas Amo Miplishtim. He will exact vengeance, retribution, on behalf of his people from the Plishtim, which, as we know, he did. He quotes the Pasuk, Ki Yadin Hashem Amo. And what Rashi is saying is, a chiddush in pshat. Do not translate the word yadin amo in the sense of judgment, a judiciary notion that he will sit in judgment over them. It doesn't mean that. It's not that type of din. It's din he will take up their cause. Like we say in Alanisim of Hanukkah, danto es dinam. He took up their cause. He takes up the cause of the Jewish people. Which means that the pasuk, as some mefarshim say, it's almost as if it says, Dan Yadin Din Amo. It's one of those mikra kotzers, where he'll take up the cause of his people. And should we ask, well, why would Rashi say this? Why not just leave it as judging his people? After all, isn't it true that even if the reference is to Shimshon specifically, he was one of the Shoftim? So he did judge the people, and the pasuk says, "V'hu shafat es Yisrael," however many years it is. So you have the simple meaning of the word could also fit with Shimshon. Why does Rashi move it to a secondary, we would say, translation? Except the Mefarshim say, very simply, because we're talking once again about the unique qualities of Dan, or in this case, the unique qualities of Shimshon. And it's definitely correct to say that Shimshon is not famous for being a judge. He's not famous for judging the Jewish people. We have no records of famous rulings handed down from Shimshon. But we have plenty records of famous episodes with Shimshon exacting retribution from the enemies of the Jewish people. And if it's all about the unique qualities of Shimshon, so Rashi says, it seems much more likely that the word din here means to take up their cause. Shimshon is famous for that, as opposed to judging them, which he did, but that's not something which is unique at all for Shimshon. Which actually brings us to the next phrase in the pasuk, Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael. Again, the simple meaning is like one of the tribes of Israel. Rashi gives two Pirushim, and neither of them are that. I mean, they're both overlooking, it seems, or looking past what would seem to be the simple translation. Ke'achad shiftei Yisrael, says Rashi, Kol Yisrael yihiyu ke'echad imo. Ve'es kulam yadin. It means ke'achad, one could put a comma there, as one, the tribes of Israel. Not like one of the tribes of Israel, but when the tribes of Israel are like one, as one, he will take up the cause of the entire Jewish people, which he did. That's the first perush. So again, to reiterate, Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael does not mean like one of the tribes of Israel, but it means as one the tribes of Israel. And as we're often conscious of the tipcha under the word Ke'echad in the Tamiyakra, which Rashi tells us elsewhere has the role of a comma in many instances. convenient for us, it looks like a comma, but it actually, if this came first. And therefore, as one, the people of Israel. Alternatively, Rashi says, Ve'od yesh lefarish, ke'achad shiftei Israel, like one of the tribes of Israel, ke'miyuchad shebashvatim, like the most choice of the tribes of Israel. And that's David, Sheba miYehuda. Yehuda's famous for leading Israel in their wars. And Dan will be there with the best of them. Ke'achad, like achad ha'am, miyuchad sheba'am. So these are Rashi's two explanations, and again we note, he's moved everywhere except for the simple translation of the words, Ka'achat Shevdei Israel, like one of the tribes of Israel. But the reason, of course, is as we mentioned before, because if it just has the simple translation of like one of the tribes of Israel, so then it doesn't sound like Shimshon is anything different, no more, no less than anyone else. So where's the bracha? You'll be exactly like everyone else. And that's why Rashi chooses not to translate the word simply, like one of the tribes, but rather when they're all together, or like the best of the tribes, like the choice of the tribes. Okay. Now, it's interesting that according to Rashi, Yaakov is making a point of equating Shimshon with Yehuda. And that has significance for a couple of reasons. After all, why does he need to be compared to Yehuda? I mean, he's his own person. I mean, what does he gain by being compared? We could say, very simply, Yehuda is the Melech. It's very good to be compared to the king. We saw a few weeks ago that in all enterprises that affect the entire Jewish people, there is always some form of partnership between the sons of Rachel and the sons of Leah. We saw it with regards to the institution of Malchus, which was firstly from Binyamin and then from Yehuda. The Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan were a collaboration of Yehuda and Dan. And therefore it could be that these major salvations and taking the cause of the entire Jewish people, it's significant. And that's what the Pasuk is highlighting, that here is Dan and he's really from the camp of Rachel. But he will take up the cause of the Jewish people alongside Yehuda from the sons of Leah. Okay. And then Pasuk Yud Zayin. Yehi dan nachash alei derech. So he's compared to a snake. In what way is he compared to a snake? Ramban says that, well, aside from the fact that a snake, in a sense, when it attacks, it's not really that type of frontal attack. I mean, Shimshon didn't really lead a military campaign in that way. He went by himself in the night, wherever it would be, more of a guerrilla style, we would say. And therefore, he's more like a snake in a sense. It wasn't an out-and-out confrontation. Moreover, the reference to biting the heel of the horse, and then the whole thing comes down. That's Shimshon, as Rashi says, and as Ramban says. His final victory was, or his final damage that he inflicted on behalf of the Jewish people towards the Plishtim, was when he brought that temple down. He pushed the pillars aside, and he's really attacking the heels, and then the whole thing collapses. And it is with reference to this final act of Shimshon that Rashi comments on that Pasuk Yud Ches L'Shuoscha Kibisi Hashem. We asked the question, I mean, what is that? Is that not appropriate for everyone? It's mentioned specifically with regards to Dan. Says Rashi, yes, because this is almost like a precursor to the tefillah that Shimshon himself offers just before he pushes those pillars apart. Zochreini na v'chazkeini achapam, remember me, give me strength. That's, the, in a sense, this is almost like a Maisa Avos injection from Yaakov of the tefillah that Shimshon will later on offer in his way, the Shuasla Kivisi Hashem, before he undertakes that feat. I saw a very interesting comment this afternoon from the Das Akeni Mibali HaTosfos, again addressing the question as to, of all the tribes, why is it that Yaakov says Lishivaso Kivisi Hashem with reference to Dan, specifically Shimshon? And the Das Akeinim say, unlike Rashi, that this is Shimshon's tefillah just before he dies, really, when he's already been captured, the Das Akeinim say that it's more of a sentiment for when he's at his prime. Because Shimshon was just unstoppable, seemingly, at that time. His strength was superhuman, and he has this incredible power. And therefore, says the Das Akeinim, there's a danger that Shimshon has that no one else really has. Namely, what will be described in the Pasuk later on in the Chumash as Kochi Va'otzem Yodi. If anyone could ever be understood for thinking that they have the power, and it's of them, and from them, and due to them, it would certainly be Shimshon. And that's something which is always a peril, but doubly so in Shimshon's case. When you're a stronger Shimshon, you can really think that it's you. And therefore, these are the words of the Das Akeinim. Kevan she'ra'a Yaakov Avinu gevuras Shimshon. When he saw in the future the strength of Shimshon, Amar, af al pi shezeh gibor notzeach, even though he is undoubtedly strong and he will have great victories, ein nachon lehishalel begevuraso. Doesn't the pasuk in Yirmiyahu say ayishalel gibor begevuraso, that he shouldn't use it to be self-serving or to praise himself? And the truth is, says the Das Akeinim, Shimshon had something of a lesson in his own experience about this. There's the famous episode where he took the jawbone of the donkey and he felled 1,000 plishtim, and that's in Shoftim Perek Tesvav. He says, and then he proclaims, Shimshon, Bilechia chamor hikisi elef ish, with the jaw of the donkey, I felled 1,000 men. The pasuk immediately says, Vayitzma ma'od, he became exceedingly thirsty, and he was on the point of collapse, and he was afraid, because if he collapsed, the plishtim would take him, and that would be a trophy for them. And at that point he says, Ad shehoda ba'omar, he admitted, Hashem atana sata biyad abdecha esetshua hagadola hazos. That's what he says at that time. He realizes he made a mistake in claiming too much of the credit for what he did, and then he became very weak, and he rectified his mistake straight away. So, of course, we mention this just to really underscore what the Das Akeinim is saying. We're not judging a Shimshon, of course, of all the people to judge. We're not judging the judges. But these are the ideas that come out from the Psukim. And right, Shehoda, at that point, Shimshon realized he needs to recognize She'ein ha'gvur rak mi Hashem levado. And that's why the Psukim, says the Das Akeinim, say he'll be the snake and he'll be powerful and he'll be va'af apichein ha'gvur v'anitzuach la'kodesh baruch hu. But at the end of the day, always got to remember, everyone, certainly Shimshon, the power comes from Hashem, as it says, lishuoscha kivisi Hashem. So it's a very interesting contrast. Whereas for Rashi and Ramban, those words are Shimshon's final tefillah as his strength is waning. But for the Das Akeinim, it's an important message when his strength is fully there. So these are the Rishonim who understand the references to Shimshon specifically. There are other Rishonim, amongst them the Rashbam, very strongly differs from that view and understands that it's about the Shevet Dan in its entirety. After all, one, it is fair to ask, if the whole bracha is about Shimshon, so then what is everyone else who's from Shevet Dan? I mean, what are they meant to do? If they live before Shimshon, so then it's not really relevant. And if they're after Shimshon, it's not really relevant. And if it's during Shimshon's time, but they're not him, also not relevant. So there's a lot of people from Dan who haven't really received a bracha, it seems. Unless Rashi would say that Shimshon represents the qualities of Dan, the best of Dan, but nonetheless, there are Rishonim who say that the reference move away from that individual. It's about the tribe of Dan. Except, what do we know about the tribe of Dan? In what way are they Dan Yadin Amo, taking up the cause of their people? Says the Rashbam, very interestingly, when the Jewish people traveled through the Midbar, Dan was responsible for those that went last. He is referred to in the Pasuk as Me'aseif L'chol HaMachanos. He gathers up. He is what we would call the rear guard. And his job is to be sure that as the Jewish people move on, no one tries to attack them from behind. And therefore the Rashbam concurs with Rashi that Yadin Amo means he takes up the cause of his people, and it is the entire Jewish people because he's protecting them, like Amalek. If they would be attacked from behind, the whole people are at risk. And therefore, when they're protected from behind by Dan, that is Yadin Amo, Ka'achat Shivtei Yisrael. Again, like Rashi, he takes up the cause and acts in the interest of the entire Jewish people as he protects them from behind. And once again, he's like the Nachash, few in number, right? But very potent. And that is how the Rashbam explains. Dan Yadin Amo, because they protect the Jewish people from the rear. The Ibn Ezra has a different perush, not only a different perush of what Yadin means, but finally a different perush as to who is Amo. Which we wouldn't imagine that there's more than one way to explain those words. Amo, his people, are the Jewish people. And yet, says Ibn Ezra, Dan Yadin refers to the tribe of Dan, like the Rashbam, the tribe of Dan. They're in a position of power or prestige. How so? Says the Ibn Ezra, the Shvatim, when we travel through the Midbar, were divided into four machanos. And each of those four camps, comprising of three tribes, had a flag. And the tribe that carried the flag was called the Rosh of that Machane. Now you'll notice that of those four, three of them are from what's called the Geviros. The Geviros meaning the of Yaakov's two wives, the two of them were Rachel and Leah, and the others were their maidservants, Bilhah and Zilpah. The first three Rosh Machanos were Degel Machane Reuven, who's the firstborn of Leah, Degel Machane Yehuda, also from Leah, and Degel Machane Ephraim, from Yosef, that's from Rachel. There's only one of the Degels, Degolim, Rosh Machanos, that are from what's called Bnei Hashvachos, from Bilhah and Zilpah, and that's Dan. And that was considered to be quite noteworthy. And that's why, says Ibn Ezra, Dan Yadin Amo Ka'achad Shivtei Yisrael, he will have this position of authority over his machane, just like the other Shivtei Yisrael, who are from Leah and from Rachel. And should we ask, well, what's the yichus of Dan? After all, there's four of the Bnei Hashvachos, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. Rabbeinu Avram, the son of the Rambam, in his commentary on the Torah, which we have on Breishis and Shemos, says something very interesting. Dan has a quality that the others don't have. That is to say, above all the four, he was the first to be born. He's the Bechor. Which is very interesting, because it's a chiddush for us that there exists a notion of Bechora within the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. Now, we understand that if you're the first of all of them, like Reuven is the Bechor, or maybe he lost the Bechora, then Yosef becomes the Bechor, but then there's this subset called the Bnei Hashvachos, and they're their own group, in a sense, and they have their own Bechor. And Dan is the Bechor, he's the first of those four to be born. So much so, says the Ibn Ezra, that what Yaakov means, and this I think is a chiddush, in fact I'll get out to read his words, so you don't have to just believe me. Ibn Ezra says, Dan Yadin Amo, Remez Shiyeh Bal Degel, he will be Rosh Degel, like we said, Ke'achad b'nei ha'gviros, like one of the sons of the Geviros, Rachel and Leah. And now, says Ibn Ezra, V'hine haya kikitzin al kol am mehashvachos. So he is then really in the position of authority on the entire am from the shvachos. Because those that were in the machane of Dan were Dan and Naphtali and Asher. So all of that, the tribes that made up that final Degel were from Bilhah and Zilpah. And I think this is a major chiddush because according to the Ibn Ezra, Yaakov himself is identifying the sons, the Shvatim from Bilhah and Zilpah as a separate people. They're called Amo, his people. Why are they his people? Because they're from Bilhah and Zilpah like him. He has more of an affinity with them. And it's very interesting just to see how far this idea goes, or what are the implications of this idea that the Bnei HaShvachos are almost Am Bifnei Atzmam, one could say. Reb Leib Hyman Zatzal, the Rav of the Groshul in Beit Vegan, has a stunning insight here. He says that you can see the relationship of the Bnei HaShvachos to the Bnei HaGeviros even in our parsha of the Brachos. Every Shevet begins with a new parsha. As we know, when we talk halachically about a parsha, it's a paragraph in the Torah. And every bracha, if you look in the Sefer Torah, begins with a new paragraph. And yet, as we know, there's two types of paragraphs in the Torah. There's a paragraph which begins on the next line, and a paragraph that begins at the end of the first line, known as psuchos and stumos. Psuchos is when the rest of the line is empty and the next paragraph is on a new line. Stumos is when it actually blocks in because it begins at the end of the line that the first paragraph ended. Suchos and Stumos. In the Chumash, it will say Pei or Samach. That's how you know. So Rav Hyman says, consider a fascinating thing. Every parsha begins on a new line. Every new bracha begins with a new parsha. But you'll note that as a rule, the brachos of the sons of Reuven and Leah, their parsha is a psucha. That means they start on a new line. The brachos from the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, they're a new parsha, but it's stuma. It's on the same line as the bracha above. And he suggests that as surely as graphically or spatially, a psucha is an entirely new line. It's not in any way dependent or reliant on its God. It doesn't share its space with anything. It's its own new parsha. So the Bnei HaGeviros, so their brachas begin on a new line, because each one was its own shevet in that way, completely unreliant on any other. Whereas the Bnei HaShvachos, it's yes and no. It's a new parsha, but it's stuma, their own thing, but still somehow dependent or reliant on, apropos of others. And it's very interesting to mention in this regard, should parenthetically, Yosef is an exception, which we can't discuss now, but just to see how far this went into the future. The Abarbanel in Parshas Matos, which is many, many years later, we're about to enter into Eretz Canaan. Abarbanel makes the comment that the two tribes that wanted to stay on the west side, on the east side, they are the tribe of Reuven. And how do they get to be together? They're known as Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. How do they meet up? Well, says Abarbanel, of course they met up. I mean, they share the same machane. That first machane, Degel Machane Reuven, has Reuven, Shimon, and Gad. So they're Shechenim. So they got to talking, and they have common interests. And Reuven, Abarbanel understands that the initiative was Reuven's to stay, for reasons he explains. Who's going to go with Reuven? God, they're neighbors. Stick together. So that Abarbanel says, but wasn't Shimon also a neighbor of Reuven's? We don't find that he stayed. And Abarbanel says, just to see, it ran very deep. Reuven finds it much easier to convince God to stay with him than Shimon, because God is one of the Bnei HaShvachos. They have less of that sense of independence. They're more inclined to be influenced by one of the Bnei HaGeviros. And therefore, if Reuven is looking for a shutuf to stay with him, and he's got two choices, Gad or Shimon, he's not going to start up with Shimon. Shimon is his equal and feels his equal in every respect. And Reuben says, I'd like to stay on this side. And Shimon will say, well, good luck to you. I'm going on the other side. And what have you got to do with me? But Gad will find it harder to resist because Gad is from the Bnei Ashvach. Ad kedei kach. What still, of course, needs to be examined is whether this division was an essential division. That is to say, was it mahuti? Is it real? Did it have to be that way? Or is it perhaps just the way, the metzias, just the way that they related to each other? They never really shook off the fact that they were, and they naturally came more psychologically to relate to the Bnei HaGvirah, but there was no reason that they needed to at all. We never think of the 12 tribes as anything less than equals with each other. In any case, these are some of the themes and questions from Parshas Vayechi. As we said, the Parshanut is a wealth here, both in a general sense and in terms of the specific sense. And the more we look into it, as we always see, we leave Baruch Hashem Gadol. For the time being, we close Chumash Bereishis, Chazak, Chazak, Venes Chazek, and next week, Mitzvah Hashem, open the Chumash of Shabbat.